two equinoxes.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with Translator K210DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
One of the things that I wanted to do in my book is to bring out the role of women in the fur trade. But there's kind of a blank there, and the historians themselves admit it. Well, that's like writing a history of American agriculture and leaving out the farmers. Indian women processed every single one of those furs that went off to Europe. They fleshed them and dried them out and then packed them up.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining me. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have great folks on, great conversations with people from a bunch of different backgrounds. We're talking artists, community leaders, healthcare advocates, educators, so many passions and gifts. And we talk to people about those gifts and how they share them with the community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And it's another day, another opportunity to amplify Native voices. And I'm really excited for our guest today. And you should be too. He's a prolific artist and very well known. So I'm really happy that he's here with me chatting. Carl Gaboy. Wouldn't you know it? Carl Gaboy is a member of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe, and he was born in Cloquet to a Finnish mother and an Ojibwe father. He was raised in Ely, and he's lived in and out of the Duluth area for the past 20 years. And his recent book is called Fur Trade Nation and Ojibwe's Graphic History. Really cool pen and ink drawings. It's like a historical graphic novel. It's really neat. I've checked it out. And his primary medium as an artist is watercolors. And I hear he's also a member of Native Sky Watchers. And as a fan of looking up to the stars, I'm going to have to make sure to ask him about that too. But I'm really excited, if you can't tell, for our guest, Carl Gaboy. There you are.
Thank you for having me.
Is that a cat platform behind you?
Yeah. So don't be surprised if you see a mountain lion pass by.
Yes. This bed right here, that is my dog's bed.
This is the computer room. It's also the cat room. So,
well, Bonjour, Carl Gaboy. Thank you so much for being here with me today. Can you introduce yourself and tell me where you're joining us from?
I'm Carl Gaboy, and I was raised in Ely. Our family was from the Vermilion Reservation, near Tower. I'm an artist. I write. I give talks. Prop me up in front of a lectern and tell me to have at it, and I will have at it.
And where are you joining me from right now? Are you in Duluth, or where are you?
Yes, I live in Two Harbors.
Okay, Two Harbors. Awesome. I just drove down the North Shore the other day. It's just beautiful this time of year. And how are you doing, and how is the family?
We're all doing really well here. We've got three grandchildren living with Cindy and I, and their folks, of course. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing we have a great big house where they can all find their hidey holes. And I have a studio that I can retreat to. So that certainly helps with the crowd here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl, what are you thinking about these days? Is there something you're concentrating on this time of year? For me, it's like a time for reflection. But is there something that you're kind of mulling over?
Well, I'm beginning to market a calendar that was together. And this calendar was based on, it's a color illustrations from my book, The Fur Trade Nation. They're beautiful as your clay prints. They're eminently frameable. So I hope people will buy them and frame up the pictures right away and put them on their wall.
Oh, that's so neat. So it's a calendar.
Yes.
With the art from your graphic book for Trade Nation?
Yes, but they're color versions.
Added color.
My graphic book was in black and white and very cartoon style. These are watercolors, full color watercolors.
That's so cool. Can you say just a little bit about what Fur Trade Nation and Ojibwe's graphic history is?
I taught the history of the fur trade when I taught in Indian Studies departments before I retired. And I taught at the College of St. Scholastica and at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And I was teaching in the Indian Studies department, and basically I taught whatever was required of me, taught many different subjects, but my specialty was art. And that was what my master's degree was in, and that's what they hired me for, to teach a survey of American Indian arts. Well, then what happened, because Indian Studies departments shift around a lot, and a lot of people come and a lot of people go. And so I was asked to cover for a lot of courses. And then I was able to come up with my own course. One of the courses I wanted to do was the history of the fur trade. Now, the reason why I wanted to do that was because most Minnesotans have no idea that for 250 years there was action going on here. Economic action, cultural action. Quite a remarkable period. Most Minnesotans aren't aware of that. I have to say most Native people aren't aware of it. It's sort of a blank, and I can very comfortably say that every single Ojibwe person worked in the fur trade industry as trappers, as guides, as interpreters, as cooks, as canoe makers. And how do you just drop 250 years out of your history? And this is what I found out. I just talking to students, they knew absolutely nothing about it. Even though about half of my students had French names, I can't think of any other place in the world where 250 years would just be dropped just like that. And most of the Indian studies approach Indian history from the kind of the pure untouched culture, you know, dress in buckskins, you know, live in bark houses, to all of a sudden to the 20th century, where they talk about the reservation period. And I kind of know where that comes from. Historians had the same type of approach when historians were big proponents of the frontier thesis, where the frontier existed, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, the modern era. But historians don't teach that way anymore. There's a new paradigm that has replaced it called a middle ground paradigm, where they recognize the fur trade. The middle ground was where two cultures really tried to understand each other. And for the most part, they succeeded. Not always. There were little events like the French and Indian War and Pontiac's War, the American Revolution, little dust-ups like that. But between 1650 and 1850, French, Scots, English, Ojibwes, Crees did business together. They married each other. Daniel Harmon, who left us a great fur trade journal from the mid-19th century, spoke Cree to his children. This is what's meant by the middle ground. Well, to me, that's kind of exciting. That's kind of interesting. And Ojibwe history isn't like other tribal histories. Other tribes didn't do that. If you're a Pueblo up until the 1960s, if you married outside of the Pueblo, you were gone. You lost all your privileges. You lost your land, lost your ceremonial rights. Boom, you were gone. And it didn't matter if you married an Anglo or a Navajo. You were gone. Ojibwe aren't like that. They welcomed outside marriages because these outside marriages brought new ideas and new ways of doing things into the village. I guess that was another reason why I wanted to teach this course, was because many of my students thought that the Ojibwe were just like all the other Indians all over North America. I traveled around quite a bit when I was in graduate school in the 1970s. And I went to the Northwest coast and I met Tlingits, went to the Southwest and I met Navajos. Plus, many of the students from many of these tribes came to the University of Minnesota and I taught there. And I tell you, they're really different. They're not like us. And they think we are really strange. So it kind of goes both ways. And so to my mind, the fur trade answered a lot of questions. History of the fur trade filled in a lot of the gaps.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, I'm speaking with Carl Gaboy. Carl is a member of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe, and he was born to a Finnish mother and Ojibwe father and raised in Ely. And he's an artist, and his latest book is Fur Trade Nation and Ojibwe's Graphic History. A colleague of mine got me a t-shirt with Fur Trade Nation, and there's two women on it, one with a knife and one with an axe.
And look at the expression on their faces. You don't mess around with them.
Heck no, I think those are supposed to be us. I think she wanted that to be G and I.
Oh.
Can you say who those women are?
One of the things that I wanted to do in my book is to bring out the role of women in the fur trade. Now, I'm not the first one to do this. It was a great book that came out in the 1980s, just when fur trade history was just starting to change. It was called Many Tender Ties by a Canadian scholar. She did all of her research talking about women in the fur trade. But there's kind of a blank there, and the historians themselves admit it. Well, that's like writing a history of American agriculture and leaving out the farmers. That's the gap that I wanted to fill. And it comes from my own background. My father was a trapper. And I grew up with traps boiling on the wood stove, sterilizing them before we go out. Because, you know, if a mink smells human scent on a trap, they won't go near it. So they have to be sterilized. One little step in modern trapping that I was a part of. And so I guess that consciousness always stuck with me. And I wanted to do something about that, about my own history.
And so women in the fur trade, what was the Ojibwe women's role?
Well, let's talk about furs themselves. Indian women processed every single one of those furs that went off to Europe. They flushed them and dried them out and then packed them up.
Mm-hmm. So is that why they had the blades in the drawing?
Yes, in my drawing, that's why that woman is holding up that knife and holding up a dead mink in the other hand.
Do you have any like favorite stories from the fur trade era? Any favorite characters?
There's a series that runs through the book called Fur Trade Jokes. These are actual jokes that historians have put together, and sometimes they come from Native people themselves, some of the jokes that I've heard. Like, for instance, this is a true story. The Governor General of Canada was taking a tour of the Canadian provinces, stopped by at Rat Portage near the town of Kenora, Ontario. He comes up and goes up to the nearest Hudson's Bay Company factory and says, I would like to meet a real Indian. And so the factor said, Scottish accent here. Aye, would ye come here for a minute, MacDonald? An Indian named MacDonald?
Oh my gosh.
Now, I showed that cartoon to white people at Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College. They didn't get it. I showed it to Indians, and they laughed and laughed.
How about we talk a little bit about your becoming an artist?
Well, my mother said that I could draw before I could walk. And I started drawing because my older brothers and sisters were all real smart. They went into fields like engineering. That wasn't me. When I first started conceiving of putting together Fur Trade Nation, it was because I kind of combined two interests. One is my background in the fur business and my interest in Ojibwe history and their connection to the fur trade. and then my interest in comics. And then Noah Harari's Sapiens series came out, and that's what inspired me. He's talking about the history of mankind, all in graphic narratives. And I thought, I can do this. So I sat down and started to do this. So I did each drawing on a single sheet of paper, computer paper, did each one separately. And that's because I was working on 3x5 cards from my lecture notes. See, I never threw away my lecture notes. So I opened up my file and started doing one at a time. So they weren't done in any order.
Excellent. Well, I want to pivot a little bit because I saw that you are a member of Native Skywatchers, which is infinitely intriguing to me.
The interesting thing about my being involved in that is that when I first was teaching in Indian studies, if you put the words Native Americans and science in the same sentence, no one would believe you. And if you certainly put Native Americans and astronomy in the same sentence, that just would not compute. But in 1978, that all changed. And that was when Anna Sofer, an artist, was hiking up on top of Fajada Butte in Chaco Canyon in New Mexico and saw a group of slabs on a ledge with a pictograph behind it. And when the sun shone through those slabs, it shone a beam of light that pierced down through this pictograph. That has been called the sun dagger, and Anna Sofer rediscovered it. And she took photographs of it. She just happened to be up there on June 21st, the solstice. And she took photographs of it and then started going around talking about the ancient Puebloans who lived at Chaco Canyon, who did this amazing thing, this amazing piece of science that marked the two equinoxes and the two solstices, and marked it with a dramatic light effect using slabs that weighed a couple tons each, maneuvered into position to make this beam of light shine through it. Well, no one believed her, and especially anthropologists. And they said that the Pueblo Indians were too ignorant of science and astronomy to have made something like that. So they made up all kinds of reasons why that occurred, that these two-ton slabs just happened to fall off the ledge above and landed on that ledge to create this beam of light going through a pictograph, right? They didn't even believe that humans did that petroglyph.
Okay, geez.
Well, then it finally happened that they found out that in a lot of the ancient Pueblo sites, there were alignments to the rising and setting of certain stars, especially solstitial risings that came just before the equinox and the solstice. Mm-hmm. People brought in the subject of the medicine wheel in Wyoming, great big stone circle that had astronomical alignments like Stonehenge was. See, it was all happening at the same time. And then the scientific world had to believe it, and they had to go along with it. And suddenly Anna Sofer became a big star. And all of a sudden, the scientific community in the Southwest just climbed on the bandwagon. And now they're talking about, like, they invented ancient Indian astronomy. So anyway, when all that happened, I thought, I wonder if anything like that happened around here. Mm-hmm. I said, what's around here that's ancient? It's a marking on the rock that's permanent. And I said, the rock paintings, Laurentian shield pictographs, of which my growing up around Ely, they are all over the place. And of course, there's about 200 of them all the way up to the Arctic. So I thought, I wonder if that has anything to do with astronomy. I wonder if they're, wait for it, constellations. And so one of the most famous examples is a pictographic site right near Ely, the Hickman Lake pictographs. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, of course, they're constellations. And not only are they figures, the big figures, the constellations, but they also mark the three important constellations marking the three seasons of the year, winter, fall, and autumn. And I thought, well, gee, you know, if that's going to be like an almanac, and if those are the three big constellations that mark the seasons, where's the summer one? Well, some friends of mine went up to the Heckman Lake pictographs, and they found the summer one. And everybody had just ignored it all these years because it was too abstract. But there it was. So I started putting together a little bit of Ojibwe astronomy and just took off from there.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, I'm speaking with Carl Gaboy. Carl is a member of the Boisfort Band of Ojibwe, and he was born to a Finnish mother and Ojibwe father and raised in Ely, and he's an artist, and his latest book is Fur Trade Nation and Ojibwe's Graphic History. Sorry, before you keep going, can you say what they look like?
Yeah, there's a great big moose figure done quite realistically. Then there's a great big human figure with arms outstretched. And then there's a panther with a curved tail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the great big figure with the arms outstretched looks like a very primitive figure. But the moose and the panther are very realistic. Same artist, right? Why did they draw the human figure so abstract? And why the moose figure is so realistic? And that's because the big human figure is a constellation. It's Orion.
Oh.
And the big, long, outstretched arms, Aldebaran and Procyon, two big bright stars on the either side of Orion.
And then where do you see these then? Are they on, like, a rock?
Yes, From Ely, you can get there in a couple of hours. Drive up the Echo Trail, see a big sign that says Heckman Lake, take a portage down to the lake, paddle about 5 miles, and there they are. They're on a big vertical cliff caused by glacial plucking as the glacier went through Heckman Lake, plucked off rocks, leaving a big sheath of cliff going down to the water.
Mm.
And that's where the pictographs are painted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the pictographs were done all over the place in this part of the country.
Wow.
But then in 1850, they abruptly stopped. So the oldest pictographs here, and believe me, they've been studied and studied and studied, Canadians especially. Most of the Laurentian Shield pictographs are in Canada. We've just got a few up in the north here. Most of them, they've been studied a lot. A lot of them have to do with the Laurentian Shield itself and the glaciers that came through and made these beautiful flat rocks to paint on. But then no one has ever been able to really define why they were painted. Many of the Canadian Ojibwes will explain it to you. The U.S. Ojibwes, just across the border, won't say a word.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why the Canadian Ojibwes now talk about them is because they want to make it clear that what they painted was something that's culturally important. And they want people to appreciate them and know about them. They're not going to hold back any secrets. But the Minnesota Ojibwes still feel, let's see, a little thing called the American Indian Religious Crimes that made Indian religion and all the art that went with it illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't ended until the Carter administration that passed the American Indian Religious Freedoms Act.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can practice our religion openly. Wow. Thanks, guys.
So it's less a secret. It doesn't need to be so much a secret.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so Native Skywatchers, it says you're a member. So I take it there are other members.
Yes.
What's the group like?
And Natalie, who is Dakota, has a PhD in astronomy and physics and a PhD in art. Now, get that.
Wow.
Can you believe it? She got hired at St. Cloud State to run their planetarium and to teach astronomy there. And she is the one that got us all together. I have to say that Dakota have worked longer and harder on this than the Ojibwe have as far as their astronomy is concerned. They started putting things together in the 1950s. And Annette Lee got in touch with many of the informants that were involved in putting all of this Dakota astronomy into written form and diagrams, star charts and things like that, connecting them with legends and stories. Then she pulls up into my yard one day and says that, I hear you have been doing some work on Ojibwe astronomy. For some reason, I gave her all my stuff. I said, sure, here's all my notes. I was a part of her organization from that point on. We put on workshops for teachers. The Minnesota legislature passed a law that in curriculum, like science, American Indian contributions to it have to be acknowledged, but nobody knew any Ojibwe science. And it just so happened that Annette Lee's organization just came out right at the same time, and they put together a curriculum, beautiful, beautiful, that any school teacher can get and use. You learn about constellations and their movement through the year, brightest constellations that are in different seasons of the year. You have star charts that you follow along. So you can learn a lot about astronomy by studying Dakota and Ojibwe astronomy, just like you can studying the ancient Greek names for these constellations.
Fascinating. Well, maybe kind of for a final question, any advice for up-and-coming artists?
Don't throw anything away and, you save everything. Do something every day and keep at it.
Carl Gaboy, just a really fascinating artist, person. So don't throw that art away. I like to make art, whether it's songs or canvas, just, drawings and stuff like that. And sometimes I just throw it away because I get kind of frustrated and I'm like, who needs this anymore? But you never know. Maybe my kid might like it someday, or maybe I'll want to look back and look at what I've done. So, Chimiigwech, Carl Gaboy. I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Kigwabamin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
What is that delightful song?
That delightful song is one that you might be more familiar with than I am. It's a common redpoll, migratory winter bird that often comes to northern Minnesota. Doesn't normally make it as far south as where I am in Stillwater, Minnesota, but I just love that kind of questioning
yeah.
sound it makes. Just sounds very inquisitive.
So red poles, we'll talk about those a little bit because mm-hmm. I don't know. These are, we're seeing all the things changing as always. This is Season Watch from KEXE, and I'm Heidi Holton with Charlie Mitchell. But also, this is the migratory time of the year. If a name is something like red pole, does it mean there's some red involved?
There is some red involved.
Okay.
They have a little red forehead patch, the males do. I wonder whether red pole, does pole have, it's P-O-L-L, not P-O-L-E. Janelle, I'm wondering about the etymology of common red pole.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what my friend Google is for.
We also, I want to pose to you, Charlie, as you work with your friend Google mm-hmm. there, that as we get closer to the holidays, what I'm really hoping for is kind of some ideas from you on curious nature folks and basically what mm-hmm. would you want in your stocking kind of a thing,
gotcha.
Books or things. So keep that in the back of your head and we'll be providing that during this podcast.
Absolutely. I have ideas.
Okay, good.
I have ideas. So pole does come from, etymology is English, it means head. So basically redhead.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There we go.
But yeah, they move in flocks. They can be super abundant at feeders, especially if you're feeding black oil sunflower seeds. They love those ones. Keep an eye out.
One question some people I know, this is also getting towards the gifts, and you don't have to answer it now. We'll put this out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if anyone listening, or you, Charlie, has any ideas or background with those bird feeders that have cameras.
Ooh.
I was
obsessed
thinking
with them.
About them of getting one for Tom, maybe for, but I don't mm-hmm. quite know if it's something I should get or if they're worth it or any of that kind of stuff. Do you want to tease us
with
an idea? I
found one on sale.
Okay.
That's sitting downstairs that I just haven't put out yet.
Oh.
So this is motivation for me to get it out there.
Okay.
And what I'm really hoping that eventually an owl will nest in it. I got one that should be about the right size. But in the winter, I'm really hoping that some flying squirrels hang out in it because then, you know, they'll be in the nest box all day while I'm awake and then out scurrying around all night when I'm asleep. And I would just be so happy to see a bunch of southern flying squirrels just snuggled up together.
Charlie's got both. Charlie's got the Home Alone look right now. If you were sitting with us on this Zoom conversation, hands on her cheeks, so excited. You know, most people don't care for the flying squirrels, right?
So I would argue that most people in northern Minnesota do not care for the flying squirrels.
Okay.
Most people in southern Minnesota have no idea that we have flying squirrels. Because they're mostly nocturnal. In the big woods area, they have plenty of places to nest that aren't people's attics.
Uh-huh.
And they're so nocturnal, you don't see them unless you're hearing them running around your attic. Gosh, they're adorable.
Hmm. Yeah, this
they're
is
so cute.
This is just my brother. I think it took mm-hmm. about 4 or 5 years to get the flying squirrels out of the walls of his house. And so it was rough for him.
I know intellectually that would be a large problem and would probably keep you up all the time and you would never get any sleep, but they're animated fuzzy little blankets.
I
love them. Can you imagine like a human-sized one and getting a hug from one? It'd be so cozy.
Oh, you've crossed into dangerous territory. That's given me the chills here.
Heidi just full body shuddered.
I'm not there yet. I'm learning so much being on Season Watch Pod with you, but I'm just going to say I'm not quite there yet, but I understand. I hear
you. I'm also a weirdo and nobody has to be there.
I
understand.
Weirdos are included. This is for nature nerds mm-hmm. like us. I'm slowly becoming a nature nerd myself. Each week we are bringing you conversations and questions. I feel like we end up leaving each episode with more questions than answers
yes.
sometimes, you know, which is great. That's what this is about.
Yep, that's the point. And honestly, that is a whole experience of mm-hmm. being engaged in nature. Is there's far more questions than answers, but all of them are interesting.
Yeah.
And what I love is hearing, you know, the kids get curious and get interested and We're going to listen to one, a report here in a second from Little Falls students. And these students know more at, I think they're in sixth and seventh grade, than I did at age 29, 30. Some, I'm still learning from them. You know, it's amazing the knowledge that they're starting out with and how much they're going to be able to discover going on. It makes me just so excited and so hopeful. And I can't wait to find out everything they learn. But yeah, this is from our Little Falls students, Chad Kaditz's science class.
This is Emily
and Megan reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phrenology report for the week of November 16th.
There were several sightings of barred owls this week, including a great video of one catching a small rodent.
This week we saw and heard both tundra and trumpeter swans.
One thing we learned this week was that northern shrikes produce a pellet similar to owls to expel bones and hair.
We are still seeing some sandhill cranes around Little Falls, so they have not all left on their migration yet.
We have noticed several different bracket fungi, including turkey tails, artist fungi, and birch polypore. We had our first snow on November 9th.
Most of us were able to get out and see the Northern Lights as it put on quite a show this week. It was a unique week as more people were sharing their pics of Northern Lights than pics of their deer.
On the forest floor, we have noticed smaller organisms that stand out, including haircap moss and British soldier lichen.
Although they are not a common sight around here, this past week we heard the unmistakable call of a raven.
A classmate found an owl pellet and picked it apart to find it was filled with chipmunk bones.
We are seeing large flocks of wild turkeys in the fields and moving through the woods.
A fellow student found a huge bald-faced hornet hive that was built on a chair in his deer stand. It was several feet tall.
This is our report for this week. Until next week,
keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Amazing.
Okay.
The things that class sees.
Yeah. All right. We've got a lot to get to here.
Yeah.
When
to begin with, on their Instagram page, which you can find at little_falls_phenology, they have the videos of this barred owl. They have photos of the Northern Lights. They have this huge flock of turkeys. Yeah, if you haven't seen their Instagram, please check it out. But this is all, like, crowdsourced from the class and from other people in their school. They send their photos to the teacher, Chad Kaditz, and he uploads them all. And it's just this fascinating document of everything going on in the Little Falls area. I absolutely love it. And then they're finding these owl pellets, northern shrike pellet.
Okay, let's talk about pellets here, because when I first heard this on Tuesday, I assumed this was like finding little rabbit pellets, right? Like scat in the woods.
Yeah, or deer pellets, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is a completely logical conclusion to jump to. In birds, a pellet is a little bit different. When we're thinking about, I don't know how into the weeds here I can get, but in mammals, the way that mammals excrete is different from how birds excrete. So mammals can both pee and poop. Birds only have one hole called a cloaca where they pee, poop, and do any reproductive things. And so the way that a bird, especially like a predatory bird that's eating a lot of stuff that's indigestible, bones, fur, that kind of stuff, instead of it passing through their entire reproductive system, it comes out as a pellet from the top end. So much like a cat horking up a hairball, this is owls and northern shrikes, other predatory birds, or things that are eating a lot of stuff that just can't be digested, will get rid of that out the top end.
The delight in your voice makes me think that you've been long examining pellets.
This may be true. This is absolutely true. Because, again, the closer you look at things, the more wonderful things you discover. And, you know, I think a lot of us were lucky enough in our science classes, at least lucky enough if you're me, horrified enough if you're some of the people in my class to, you know, do the dissection of owl pellets. And you find all these tiny little bones. You know, the Little Falls students were talking about looking through the pellet and finding out there were the bones of a chipmunk. I know from my end, you know, you can go through and you can find bones, but identifying them is a whole different ballgame. There's some very useful dichotomous keys you can use, but I won't get into that. But yeah, you do find all sorts of fascinating things just hidden in that stuff. And the good thing about owl pellets is that they're very dry. They don't have much of a smell, or it's just the fur and bones with almost no, like, digestive waste attached. Whereas things that come out the other end tend to be a little bit more wet and smelly, and
they've been,
you know,
they've
you
gone
might
through,
not want to.
It's like they've gone through some process.
Where they this, have, this yeah. They've gone to... through the entire digestive tract and come out smelling like it. The pellets, less so. But John Latimer was also surprised to hear about this northern trike pellet. And so while talking with Clinton Dexter Ninehouse from the Saxon Bog, they discussed that a little bit. So I wanted to highlight that this week.
I had a report this morning from one of our student groups, and a pretty well-informed, and they reported that the shrike actually regurgitates a pellet, much like the owls, and I was unaware of that, so tell me more.
Well, if you ever want to see one, John, I've got one in my freezer right now, so...
You're talking about the pellet, not the shrike.
Yeah, so...
What did I do?
Birds that eat things with bones and they can't process them, like fish or mice and voles, or even hard-shelled things like beetles. Kestrels and merlins cough up pellets. Grebes will cough up pellets. Owls and almost all of our raptors will cough up pellets. But yeah, shrikes are fun. That was a bird that, that pellet, the story I have with that, I was guiding a couple of folks. God, this would have been like 2017 or earlier. And we saw this shrike, and it didn't fly away right away. And usually when you see a shrike, they just sort of disappear. Like, you get a good look at one, and then they're gone. But this bird was sitting, and I said, well, let's just watch this bird. This is kind of interesting that it's not going anywhere. It's either hunting, or it's doing something else. And we watched it do that sort of, like, hunched back thing. I was like, oh, I know what's going to happen here, you guys. Watch this. And it popped up the pellet, flew away, and I got out of the car, and I ran into the ditch, and I dug through the snow. And I found that pellet, and I have that shrike pellet in my freezer now. I've been trying to figure out what to do with it, because that's not a thing you find a lot of.
No.
And so I you know, want to put it in resin, or I want to put it in something just to have it for education. But there's a skull in it, so you can see, like, the top of the skull of whatever I've eaten in the pellet. So I don't really want to take it apart to see what it was, but, like, I don't know. It's kind of a neat thing you see when you're out and about in the world.
Now, Charlie's...
I am really enjoying Heidi's response to all of this.
Yeah, Charlie's smiling the whole time. We don't have time for it, but I would like to go one by one at some point to see what's in each of your freezers, because I suspect all three of you have some things in there we maybe want to know about, but maybe not. But anyway.
For sure.
The for sure.
I love that you had the exact same set of reactions this time around. Yeah, you did still, last time.
I keep talking about, I keep learning. I'm still not quite there on. And now that I think about it, John definitely said regurgitation there. So I should have known better. But, you know, I'm still thinking about the pellet, not the, you know, basically.
I think that's a very reasonable assumption to have made, especially because we do talk about deer pellets and rabbit pellets all the time. But I think that's part of the reason why scientists come up with such ridiculous words, is that there are these very fine nuances that, like, you do need technical terms to work with. But then you get to the difference between predation and depredation, and I start rolling my eyes a little bit.
I love that Clinton there is... like, he's a detective, right? He's seeing this shrike making this movement where he knows he might have access to a pellet. And then he's gonna stop the car and dive into the ditch of snow to find it. Oh, my gosh.
Right? The number of, like, naturist levels you have to have leveled up to reach that. Because first of all, the shrike is a very nondescript bird. It's gray and white and a little black.
About how big,
I think,
of a bird is the shrike?
Okay, someone who's listening is going to come fight me on this.
No, it's okay.
But I would go with, like, robin size.
Okay.
I would say about robin size. It could be mistaken for a gray jay, but I think a little bit smaller than that. But just in terms of the coloration. And so the vast majority of us would be driving by this bird, not even thinking about it. probably not even seeing it. Not Clinton. Clinton stops, sees it doing the, like, cat about to puke up a hairball thing, and is like, buckle in, guys. We're in it. And then herring off to go dig it out. These are the people that I need in my life. And, like, this is also the kind of behavior that has gotten me a lot of weird looks in my lifetime. And so it's very validating to hear from other people who do these things.
Yeah, and I'm going to hold the three of you to the freezer check at some point. I think that would be fun.
I probably have more things to admit to than listeners would approve of. But I mean, talk about delight. You have to be a good naturalist to see that opportunity at all. But then you also have to have this childlike joy. Like, you can hear in Clinton's voice how excited he is to see some bird hawk up a disgusting pellet. And that's, just fills my little heart with joy.
If this is automatically bringing up stories for you, or you want to ask us a question here, don't forget you can interact with us. The Season Watch Pod, we do that through SpeakPipe. It is speakpipe.com/season_watch_pod, but you can find a link to that on our webpage or your podcast platform. And Clinton, we should say, from the Sac Zimbog, the naturalist there.
Yes. The naturalist, only naturalist who's on staff there. There are many other people who are knowledgeable in the area, but yes, truly a person who has found their calling. He knows that area very well. And
yeah, I think that is one of the, there are so many hidden gems. You know, mm-hmm. Of course, my focus is more of northern Minnesota, but I also know where you live or the state of Minnesota in general. There are places mm-hmm. that you can go and experience wildlife. You can walk, you can, yes. I mean, all of these sorts of things. And the Sac Zimbog, I've only kind of driven through there. It's, mm-hmm. it's a large expanse with a lot of different land types within it that bring in a lot of yes. different creatures.
Yeah, at least in my experience, completely unique place. Because the land is, I believe, majority privately held, although the Friends of the Sac Zimbog do own part of the land. But most of the birders who visit are birding by car. There are some trails and stuff that you can go on, but the vast majority of people are visiting in cars and driving around looking for these incredibly charismatic, gorgeous birds like great gray owls or snowy owls. The owls are a big deal. You also have all of the like beautiful evening grosbeaks, crossbills, all of these fascinating migratory creatures. You get my favorites, the pine martens sometimes pop out to visit some of the bird feeders. But to anyone just driving through who hasn't visited internationally to get there, these are just some country roads mm-hmm. that, like, you drive along and then all of a sudden you see, like, 30 people out on the side of the road with lenses the size of your entire thigh all pointed somewhere in the forest. And what? I will say the people watching is almost as good as the bird watching.
We took a different route as we were headed to the North Shore this year, and we ended up going mm-hmm. through Duluth. Help me remember the name of where I went, where all the Hawk Ridge. I was going to say, where mm-hmm. all the hawks are. There we go. And yep. for so long, we were in conversation with Laura Erickson for The Birds, a great segment you hear on Mondays. And I always imagined Hawk Ridge would be like, oh, a giant visitor center, you know, sort of like a little state mm-hmm. park and have all this stuff. But this is what we found, a road where a bunch of cars mm-hmm. were parked, a bunch of people with giant lenses and things hanging around their neck. And there was mm-hmm. almost like a food truck of items about nature that they just bring. It doesn't sit there all the time. And the wonderful staff were in there. And people mm-hmm. were so kind. Telling, you know, like, we had just missed mm-hmm. some really good stuff. We were there in a good weekend. They just invited us in, man, and were showing us everything. And it was not what I thought it would be. And it was kind of a lot better I do want to say a couple things about Sac Zim. So when I was getting ready for our conversation with Clinton, I was looking into the land there and the habitat. And, okay, so it's a black spruce and tamarack bog. It's an upland aspen maple forest, floodplain forest, sandy upland pine stands, rivers, lakes, farms, meadows, and towns in there. So there is so much. It's a beautiful place. But I also want to put this alert out there because every year our good friends and the estimable hosts of Green Cheese Trivia, the Crab Sisters of Julie and Betsy, live in Meadowlands. And they are so angry every year that people do not realize people live there. People will just stop in the middle of the road and not realize, like, there is a life here. Some people are headed to work, you know, picking up their kids, doing the normal life stuff, that, you know, it is a place where people live as well.
And, you know, people get so excited about a bird that they're, like, throwing their binoculars at a person's house. Maybe let's not do that. Yeah, if you are headed to the bog, Friends of Zaxxon Bog website, let me look it up here, has a great birding the bog etiquette page that I highly recommend you look through. It's saxzim.org, S-A-X-Z-I-M.org, and birding the bog etiquette. You'll find it. It's easy to find on their page. But yeah, there are real people who are making their lives here and, like, do need to go to work and have already seen that great gray owl five times. So just be sure you're being respectful.
But I will say, all the years I've known the crabs, their enthusiasm of getting to live there and what they see has not waned. And if you maybe, you know, get to know them a little bit, they may tell you where to go. They know what's going on. I'm not saying, I'm not giving out a phone number or anything. I need to follow up myself. That's going to be one of my goals, is go visit and have them drive me around.
As with anything else, building relationships, not just with the land, but with the people. It's really important. And yeah, I had the joy of seeing Julie Crab when my wife and I visited last year, and it was delightful.
Oh, I didn't. I recommended that to you. I don't think I remember that you actually did it.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, it was great. It was just a brief hi and bye, but yeah. And, you know, I've known of Julie Crab for forever. I've met her, I think, at Riverfest a few times, but it was great to actually, like, get to see her in her natural habitat, so to speak, and go explore that natural habitat, too. I didn't see a pine marten, but this year I will.
Well, we would love to hear from you. Are there some special places? I mean, sometimes people want to keep them secret, but are there trails? Are there places that you go that you get more connected, feel more curious? And want to pass them on to others, so we also have those feelings. Let us know through a voice message, through SpeakPipe. We'd love to hear from you. In fact, we had a absolutely lovely message this week. Maybe someone you know? I'm not sure.
Maybe someone I know pretty well, yeah. My own dear mother, Barbara, sent us a voice memo, and let's listen in.
Good morning, Heidi. Good morning, Charlie. I'm recording a voice memo because my daughter said, "Record a voice message, Mom. I'm busy." So I have a comment about this week's podcast. And it has to do with night vision and the ability to see the amazing northern lights, which we were outside watching, and they were quite amazing. And as usual, my sisters and Haley, my lovely daughter-in-law, caught beautiful pictures of the northern lights on their cameras, as you mentioned in the podcast, much better than what I could see with my eyes. And I just want to mention one additional detail that you probably know all about, but you didn't mention, and that is our amazing retinas. And they have rods and cones in your retina. Your cones are responsible for color vision. They're right in the back, in the center of your eye, in an area called the macula. And there are three kinds of cones. They're responsible for color. And rods, which are throughout the back of the retina, can detect black and white. They're really sensitive to pick up light. That helps you see in the dark. But they're not good at seeing color.
Charlie.
Thank you, Mom.
A whole family full of dorks. Your words, not mine.
But yes, that is what I just sent you over chat. Yeah, we do have a whole family full of dorks. Now, I would like to set the record straight here.
Okay.
That I did not say, I'm too busy, mom, send a voice memo. What happened from my perspective is, move the curtain a bit. We record this on Wednesday and goes out Thursday. By Friday, it's already in my rearview mirror, and I'm working on the newsletter. So I unsuspectingly finished up the newsletter on Friday. My cousin had a wedding that evening, so I'm one of those millennials who's lucky enough to live right next door to their parents. Our shower is broken, so I went next door to use theirs, trundle on up the stairs, and I hear my mom say, I'm listening to your podcast. It's great. I say, thank you. And, like, get three steps closer to the bathroom when I hear mom's chair, like, drag back from the sewing machine, and then her little feet come over, and she rounds the corner, like, finger already wagging in my direction, going, it's rods and cones, honey. It's rods and cones. I have no context for what she's talking about. I'm thinking shampoo and conditioner. And I go, what? You're talking about light sensitivity? And you're talking about, you know, like the shutter length of cameras, but you're not talking about rods and cones. Okay, now I understand what we're talking about. But lest she think that I'm spreading misinformation on the internet, she does have a point. When I'm talking about light sensitivity, talking about the sensitivity of our rods and cones. And so, for instance, I was talking last week about how I could see the reds really well in the sky, but the greens appeared more white. And Dr. Barbara has a point. That is because of the sensitivity of our rods and cones. The red light was putting out enough light energy, enough photons, for my rods to be able to pick it up. The green was light enough for my cones, the black and white ones, to pick it up, but not for my rods to pick it up. So yes, Mother, rods and cones are very important. Let's set the record straight.
I don't even want to say the word eyes anymore. I just want to say rods and cones. Like, how's my
rods and cones?
How are my rods?
Rods and cones.
Yeah. How are my rods and cones looking today, Charlie? I love it. You never know.
Yep.
Where conversations are going to lead people, and what learning, even from your mother, we are going to get. You know.
Yep.
So, Barbara,
I also think you can hear in that voice message the clear, I must have been a very obnoxious teenager, because you can hear her say, I know you probably already know this,
yeah,
but I just wanted to point out, I'm sorry, Mom, for whatever I put you through.
And Barbara, you're invited anytime to contribute to the podcast, because it was wonderful to hear from you. So, and thank you for listening. I'm assuming Dr. Barbara is also telling other people about it, which is what we hope. We hope more and more people listen. Mm-hmm. We hope more and more people use their rods and cones and just go to the website and click on that start recording button and send us a message, right?
Yep. You know, use those rods and cones to go investigate an owl pellet.
What is wrong with me, Charlie? That's your band name this week, Rods and Cones.
Oh, Rods and Cones?
Of course, yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you for listening to another edition of Season Watch. We have had a delightful time, and we're glad that you are with us. It is a production of KAXE, the first rural public radio station in the nation.
Yes. Our classroom this week was from Little Falls, Chad Kaditz's classrooms. And thanks to good old community science, we have these wonderful recordings of the bird calls. We had the common redpoll, and then the common raven is going to send us out. And those are courtesy of Paul Marvin through Zeno Canto.
And thanks again to the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Again, what are we hearing now?
This is the common raven, also known as my dad's ringtone.